This is 4:55 on Friday, December 2nd. Good morning. Wow. Friday, next to last week of class. Yeah, well, I don't know what other people are. I suspect senior project, senior design projects, all kinds of things are impacting here at the moment. All right, so recall that on Monday we're going to take a little time to look at any issues cropping up at the project, in the proxy project, so come prepared for that. But that won't be the whole class on Monday. Today, we're and I sent back the Chapter 5 assignments. Everybody should have gotten that this morning. Didn't look like there was much detailed comments. Only about half the class turned it in, and most everybody who did well, so good. I appreciate the seasonal costume. Thank you. It's a little contradictory in that it says December 25th in one way, and the other way it says about April 8th or so. But, yep, you got to confuse the listener. All right. So, to starting to talk about public key cryptography last time, and remember that the idea is that we do encryption with one key and decryption with a different one. And the convention that we're using here is that the plus means public and the minus means private, and the suffix, the subscript means whose key it is. So in this case, Bob's public key, Bob's private key. And so in order to send something to Bob, you encrypt it with the public key, right? That means nobody can read it, including you, right? Because you don't have a private key. And only Bob can read it because Bob keeps the private key private. And as I said, this was an invention of the mid-1970s, a completely new way of looking at the problem of cryptography. RSA is sort of the most famous of these algorithms still used today. Stands for the names of the last names of the authors. There were previous attempts doing public key cryptography before the RSA algorithm. It turned out they they all had fundamental weaknesses and were soon broken. But the idea that was there in them was what led these guys to be able to do this. Subsequently, there are new algorithms that use different mathematical principles for doing this public key arrangement, but they go by names like elliptic curve cryptography and things like that. And all of these are based on mathematical properties that are easy to do in one direction and hard to do in another direction. And that's what it essentially boils down to. And in the case of RSA, that mathematical problem that's easy to do in one direction is multiplying two large prime numbers to get another large number. The hard problem that you need to solve in order to break the cryptography is to factor the large number, and factoring is a hard problem. So, the other thing you have to say about all this is that all arrangements are based on things that people think are hard problems. The mathematical and algorithms community has no solution to the problem of factoring that runs fast, but there's nothing that's provable that says factoring must be fast, must be slow. So we're sort of at the mercy of something coming along at some point in the future where somebody says, I know how to factor numbers fast.
And quantum computing is one such possible route to fast factory, but nobody is currently building quantum computers that can handle anywhere near the number of bits that would be required to do that. So there's some risk associated with building society on building a digital society on these public key algorithms, but on the other hand, nobody really knows what that risk is, and it's certainly very practical in the meantime. So we keep doing it.
Okay, so what we're going to do now is go through the RSA algorithm, and
some of you have seen this before and others haven't. We'll just through it, and then we'll look at an interesting systems level flaw that has been discovered associated with RSA. It's not a flaw in RSA itself. It's a flaw in the way that RSA has been deployed that has the potential to get people in trouble. It also is fixable. So here we go. First of all, modular arithmetic. The remainder that you get when you divide something by something else, right, is x mod n. And we have these nice little facts that if you add two things and take mod n of it, it's the same thing as adding them directly and taking mod n, right? And same for subtraction, multiplication. And given this, then you can see that exponentiation is going to work the same way, and that's all just very handy in these computation in the analysis that we're going to do. Okay, so messages are any bit patterns, and as I said, prior to public key cryptography, symmetric key cryptography largely took the position that they were just the patterns that were going to manipulate the bit patterns by looking things up and substituting and shuffling and all those things. Public key cryptography was based on recognizing that a bit pattern could also be treated as a number. And so we're going to do actual arithmetic operations on the message now as a number. It's going to be a very large number, right? Because it's a lot of bits in a message, but it's still a big number. Okay, so
that's that.
So here's RSA. We start by choosing two big prime numbers, P and Q. We always call them P and Q. I don't know why, but we do. And we multiply them together to get N, and we always call it N. Just then, but that's what we do. And then we also compute this number z, which is p minus 1 times q minus 1. All right? So what do we know about z, given that p and q are large prime numbers? Very basic fact.
Semi-prime is
I do it. Even more basic than that. Z is less than n, yeah, that's one thing. I'd also observe that z is even, right? Because it's the product of two even numbers. I don't know whether that's relevant or not, but as you're thinking about the space, it may help to notice these things. Okay, so now, yeah, question?
Oh, isn't 2 prime? Wouldn't that make that odd?
So the P and Q are large prime numbers. Okay. so they're not two. All right. Then we pick a number E that is relatively prime to Z. Right. So what do we know about E? Well, if Z is even, then Z must be odd. Because otherwise they'd have two. It's just a very basic little thing, but it sort of gives you some sanity checks as you're working problems, right? To notice these things. Okay, then, So that's not too hard. Because although factoring is hard, determining whether something, whether two numbers have a common factor is easy. Okay? That's the Euclid's algorithm. So we can pick an E that has no common factors with Z, and then we can also pick D such that E times D minus 1 is divisible by Z, or ED mod Z equals 1. Now, how to go about doing this is not entirely obvious, but there are algorithms for doing these choices that make them easy. So this is all part of the setup. You do it once. It isn't rocket science to do this. And then we take the public key to be N together with E, and we take the private key to be N together with D. Notice that the way that we chose E and D, E and D are symmetric. So you could switch them around and do it the other way. You just have to decide which one of them is going to be private and which is public. It doesn't matter, really, which one you make private or public.
Okay. All right.
So NE is the public key. So what are we going to do when we encrypt? We're going to use NE as the key. And to that, we take our message, raise it to the power E, and take the result mod N. This is all just seems completely arbitrary, but it all works out. Okay, so C now stands for our ciphertext, which is a number. The other important thing that kind of slips by here sometimes that people don't notice is that M must be less than N. You can't encrypt a number that is bigger than the product of the two primes that you started with. Okay? And then to decrypt, we take that ciphertext to the power D mod N. Okay, that's not too hard. And what we need to show is that this quantity, M to the, if we substitute into this equation, this is C, which is equal to M to the E mod N to the power D, is equal to M, right? That's what we need to show here on the next slide. Because if that's true, then we have an encryption system. If it's not true, it doesn't work. So we'll sort of plow through an example, and then we'll get to the proof, I guess. So these are much too small prime numbers, 5 and 7. N is 35. Z is 4 times 6 is 24. Pick E is equal to 5. Doesn't really matter as long as it's prime. And then we need to find D, and it happens to be 29. Okay? So we take our number, which is 12, we raise it to the E power, the fifth power, and we take that mod N, and hopefully they've done the arithmetic here. I didn't check it. Anybody who wants to do this, Python 3 does arbitrary precision integers by default, so you can just plug these numbers into a Python script and check it out. That's the easy way to do it. Okay, then we take C to the D power and D being 29. 17 to the 29, and take that mod 35 and hope get back 12.
Okay. Well, I didn't check them all this time, but I've done it before, and I think it's okay. The slides for the previous edition of the book were wrong. They didn't do this right, but I think this set is okay. Okay. So that's just a simple illustration. I think there's an example in the homework that has you do that. Yeah?
Are they interchangeable, the decrypt and the encrypt?
They are. That's why I said, it's completely symmetric. You just pick one of them to be the private key, and you pick the other one to be the public key, but which one you pick doesn't matter. You just have to be consistent about it, right? You don't want to go revealing the wrong one. Okay.
So C to the D mod N is equal to M, where C is equal to N. All right. So let's skip this little fact here for a second and just expand this. C to the D mod N is, this is C to the D mod N. And by that property we had about modular arithmetic before, we can bring the exponent inside and have MED mod N. Okay? And then we need to come up here to this little fact, which says M to the ED mod N is equal to M to the D mod Z. Okay? That's a fact, that a number theory fact that we're going to use here in a second. So if that's true, and this is only true if N is one of these products of primes and Z is appropriately related. But we'll just take this fact and use it down here, which says that M to the ED mod N is equal to M to the ED mod Z mod N. And think back to how we chose E and D. We chose E and D so that ED mod Z was equal to 1. So this is M to the 1 mod N. Okay? And that equals M, provided what? That M is less than N. Right? If M is less than N, then M to the 1 is less than N, and therefore equal to M. Okay? If M is bigger than N, this is still true, but this next step is not true. Okay? So that's the description of why it works. And so it's really simple. It's kind of obscure at this point, but these exponentiation operators are actually rather computationally expensive. So this is a rather slow process by the standards of other symmetric key encryption algorithms. But it does work. Okay. And then I think we observed before that it didn't matter which of these you chose. It turns out that you can use them in either order. Right? So let's see. This case, we're going to talk about later, this case is what we just described, where we use the public key to encrypt the message and then decrypt it using the private key. We use that to send messages to Bob. How about this one? What does that correspond to? That says that Bob encrypts with the private key. It has to be Bob that does that because it's Bob's private key, right? He's the only one that's allowed to do that, or that should be doing that. So Bob encrypts with his private key, which means that anybody can read it. So what does that give us? We're going to talk about this more later. That's signing. Right? That's where Bob is proving that he's the one who has the private key that corresponds to that public key. Okay. So that's possible.
Yeah, all right. So why is it secure?
So we said it's slow, and in order to overcome that slowness, the typical thing to do is to use RSA to exchange a message that says, this is the key, this is the cement key that we're going to use for encryption in this session. So that's called a session key. So you do that one, that thing once doing an encryption, and thereafter you have a key that you can use that's much faster. And so this usage of RSA is really solving the key distribution problem for symmetric key. Because if you and I want to talk and we have, I have a public key that you know, then you can send me a key that says, let's use such and such a key as a symmetric key, and I can decrypt it, and then we agree on that symmetric key, and off we go.
There are other sort of more direct ways that use public key cryptography-like techniques for establishing session keys as well. You don't necessarily have to use RSA, but what they don't do is authenticate that I'm really talking to Al. Now this is terrible, Andrew. I was going to have you be Alan, and then I was going to have you be Joe, because when I was in grad school, I knew a Joe Bates. I've known Andrew for how long? Have I known Andrew? 6 years. 5 years, 6 years, and we work together on things. So, when you know, that's what the mind does sometimes. It happens. Okay. So that's good. All right. Now, I want to go back here.
All right, so here's the system flaw that was discovered in this thing. There are sort of mathematical traps lurking in here as well. It turns out that some prime numbers are not as hard to factor out of products as other prime numbers are. And so you need sort of serious mathematical attention to which prime numbers you're using for this. So that's one issue. But the system level flaw was a while back, a couple years ago, some researchers said, okay, we're going to look at all the public keys that we could find on the internet. Right? And it turns out the public keys are published widely as part of certificates. We'll get to the use of certificates here in a second. So there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of public keys that are sort of distributed on the internet, available by contacting servers, and so on and so forth. So they said, we're going to look at all of those public keys, and of course, every public key has embedded in it a product of two primes. And they said, what if we take those products of two primes and we run Euclid's algorithm on them pairwise. So,
I will see if I can write here. So I have N1 equal to P1 times Q1, and I have N2 equals to P2 times Q2.
A pair of these products of two primes. And let's consider what happens if, first of all, what happens if you chose P and Q and I happened to choose P and Q so they were the same? Suppose that N1 is equal to N2.
but one of them is mine and the other one is yours. What happens? Then I can read all of your messages and you can read all of my messages. I can sign for you and you can sign for me. That's a bad thing. So they found a few of those where different certificates had the same prime number in them. It was not completely clear that those prime numbers belonged to different people or different organizations. On the other hand, it was not completely clear that they didn't. Right? And so this is a risk. If two parties end up independently choosing the same prime numbers, then they can read each other. Okay. Not a good thing. But it gets worse. Because suppose now that P2 and P1 are the same. Q1 and Q2 are different.
But P1 and P2 are the same.
N1 and N2 are different.
But Euclid's algorithm run on N1 and N2. Remember, Euclid's algorithm is find the greatest common divisor for two numbers. It's very fast. So you run Euclid's algorithm on N1 and N2, and what pops out?
Is P1.
Okay? Now, why is this bad? Because you can get, given P1, you can easily get Q1 and Q2. Okay? So, if any two parties ever choose one factor in common, it's actually worse than if two people choose two factors in common. Because in the case of two factors in common, just those two people can talk to each other. But if you have one factor in common, anybody who notices that can factor both of them and impersonate both of them. So it isn't just those two, it's everybody who sort of has access to those. They found hundreds of thousands of those pairs that could be found. So then you have to ask why. And this is where the system perspective comes in. Where do prime numbers come from for this process? Well, they typically come from a prime number, a pseudo-random prime number generator that is part of your operating system and or language libraries, something. And notice that they are pseudo-random, right? They start with a seed, and they run some computations, and out pops this number, and you test it and say, oh, it's prime, and so we're good to go. And apparently, there were quite a few people, organizations, that were using flawed prime number selection processes. That were not sufficiently seeded with actual random stuff. Actual random stuff typically comes from things like when the system starts up, how do you move the mouse, and what are the timings between various things that happen. It's kind of a black art is to find actual random stuff to use these. And apparently, you know, either they were not sufficiently seeded, or they were just bad random number generators in the first place, so that people ended up with, you know, numbers that were hundreds of bits long and nevertheless were the same in two different topics. Okay? So that's the kind of trap that lurks for the unwary in this sort of stuff, is that somebody who can marshal
A lot of computing resources can exploit the system level flaws, not just mathematics level flaws.
So I thought that was a good story. I very much like that story. That's that's sort of what we're up against, how the natural world conspires against us in trying to do some of these things. Questions about this? So we did that. Okay, so now we get to authentication.
So in my opinion, cryptography is the easy problem. It's the sexy problem, but it's also the easy problem. The real hard problem is figuring out how someone's digital identity corresponds to their physical identity. There's been a lot of work on this, and the results overall are not all that terrific.
I'll say more later. So let's just try to sort of go through what you do when you try to accomplish this. So Bob wants to know that he's talking to Alice. So Alice says, "I'm Alice." Well, that's not all that useful, right? Trudy could say, "I'm Alice too." That doesn't help. So, what if we try to accomplish this by including something like Alice's IP address as part of the "I'm Alice" message? Well, we know already what the problem here is, that Trudy can say Trudy's IP address and say, "I'm Alice." Or Trudy can say Alice's IP address and say, "I'm Alice." Doesn't sort of matter. Spoofing. Well, now we're getting a little bit more plausible. Alice sends her password to Bob that Bob knows, and Bob accepts that. Well, no, because why? Remember our model of what Trudy could do. Trudy could see Alice's password at some point and sometime later produce Alice's password herself. Okay, that's called a playback attack.
How about Alice sends an encrypted password? It says, "I'm Alice."
Same problem, right? Trudy can still play back the encrypted password. All right. So now we get to a common technique that is used in these protocols called the use of nonces. N-O-N-C. Word that means a number that's used once in a life. Only ever used once.
And the way we use these is to ensure that a communication can't be played back. So
let's see how this goes. I'm Alice.
Bob picks a number. Bob picks the number now, not Alice. Bob picks the number and sends it to
Alice and requires her to encrypted
with a shared secret. Okay, so when it comes back, Bob knows that he actually had that conversation with Alice and not with somebody else. Okay, so that's sort of okay in the case that Bob and Alice have a symmetric key that they share. How about using public key cryptography? I'm Alice. Bob sends The nonce, Alice replies with the nonce encrypted with her private key. Bob says, send me your public key. He can then check, and all looks good. Where's the flaw? What? Well, yeah. Essentially, somebody could sit in the middle because there's no way to ensure that this message actually came from Alice. Right? There's no binding, and this is what I mean about the binding between the digital world and the real world. There's no way in this protocol to ensure that KA plus here is actually Alice's public key and not somebody else's. And if you back up that observation, you can do, as you said, figure out how to do a person in the middle attack on this. Okay? So, yeah. Right.
So that's... That's the essential problem with that. So let's just hold that in abeyance for a moment, that problem of associating people with real world, associating digital information with real world people, and go on and talk about message integrity. So let's assume that Bob and Alice have established that they are who each other thinks they are, to their satisfaction. Then we have the problem of, suppose Bob and Alice want to make sure that each is receiving the messages that the other sent, that they haven't been corrupted or injected or something. So this is the problem of message integrity or message authentication, which is a little bit different than this initial problem of how do Bob and Alice figure out who each other are in the first place. Once they've done that, we still have to ensure that all the messages they exchange meet the criterion of coming from each other. Okay? So we said back there when we were talking about RSA that there is this idea of doing digital signatures. Right? The idea that if you encrypt with the private key, then somebody who has the public key can decrypt and ensure that the message has not been changed. When done in a full-blown setting, this provides not only verification to the satisfaction of the receiving party, it also produces evidence that can be shown to a third party that the message came from who it purported to come from. Okay? So that's the idea of third-party verification of these signatures. If you don't require third-party verification, then you can sort of back off and use some other techniques, but we'll start with the sort of full-blown one, I think. Okay, so we said we encrypt with the private key, we decrypt with right. We haven't gotten to the decryption yet. We send the message along with its signature, and then Alice can check that. Okay, so you can work through this. We've seen the math multiple times now already. This non-repudiation property says that Alice can take the signature and the message and show it to somebody else and establish that Bob really sent it. Again, a system level concern here, right? The mathematics is sort of provably good up to the goodness of RSA, but the system consideration here is that
if you want to be really careful, you say that Alice can take M and the signature to court and prove that someone having Bob's secret key signed the message. Right? From the mathematics point of view, that's what you're proving. The inference that Bob signed the message depends critically on the knowledge that Bob is the only one that has the private key. And there, although I don't know of any instances where this has come up in this public key cryptography setting, this inference that somebody is the only one who knows something has caused a lot of trouble in things like ATM machines, especially in Britain. For many years in Britain, people were getting actually thrown in jail when they reported people stealing money using their ATM numbers. The victims would get thrown in jail because the banks would claim that they were the only one who was supposed to know the PIN number. The money was gone. They were now complaining that they didn't have the money. They were the only one who could have taken it, so they must be doing fraud on the bank. And people actually got put in jail over this. Okay? And it's based on this flawed inference that if something is supposed to be secret, then it is secret. Right? And that's a pretty dangerous mistake to make. So whenever you go through one of these analyses, keep in mind that the assumptions that you're making for the mathematics may not correspond to the real world assumptions. Okay. Well, encrypting large messages is hard work, right, with RSA. And it turns out that our previous trick of using symmetric keys for authentication authentication of messages our previous trick of using symmetric keys for encryption of messages doesn't really carry over to the signing case, because if you use symmetric key encryption for signing, which you can do, you lose non-repudiation because the person who received the message can now forge a message and take it to court and say, look what Alice sent me, but the receiver made it all up. Okay? So it doesn't have non-repudiation. Using public key cryptography is still a good idea for this message authentication stuff, doing so for large messages is a pain. So that leads to the idea of using hash functions. This is what you were asking about earlier, Jared. Using hash functions to reduce the size of the thing that you are required to encrypt. Instead of encrypting the whole message with public key cryptography, you now encrypt only a smaller chunk that is the result of using the hash function. So large messages, hash function produces a fixed size fingerprint called of a message. Notice that hash functions are necessarily many to one. There are many inputs that will produce any given output. Why? You heard of the pigeonhole principle, right? So if we have arbitrarily long messages and they all get reduced to a fixed size length, then there have to be many more messages that hash to a particular value than there are values. So necessarily many to one, fixed size. And we require, even though it's many to one, that it is difficult to find a new message that produces the same. That's what makes all this work, is that although it's easy to go from a message to its hash value, it's hard to go from the hash value to any of those many, many messages that might attach to it. That's
sort of essential. Now,
there are many hash functions floating around, and not all of them are good hash functions for this purpose. The internet checksum is an example of a really bad hash function for this purpose. Primarily because it's so short, right? There are only 65,000 hash values, and it's really no problem at all to find messages that correspond to each and every one of them and just have them in your back pocket. So we wouldn't want to do that. It's also the case, so that's one issue. The other issue is that because of the way it works, it's also the case that things don't change very much, things change in a very predictable way when you change a single byte. And we need to not be able to do that.
So internet checksum is a bad hash function. Good hash functions are hash functions like, we'll get to that. So what do? We take our large message, we hash it, we sign the hash, and we send the message along with the signature to the recipient. The recipient verifies the signature by taking the large message, hashing it using the same algorithm, and then comparing whether the received hash is equal to the one that they computed themselves. Okay, so after having checked the signature on the received hash. Yeah?
Is there anything else usually encrypted on top of that using the session key?
So if we want to add encryption over this, we can do that, right? That's easy enough to do.
These things can be layered in different ways, and again, layering in different orders produces different kinds of results from a system perspective. Okay.
So, I added a bullet to this. This bullet is not in the slides that are on the website. New information relative to what was true when the slides were made. MD5 has been broken, essentially. There are computationally not too bad ways to find strings that correspond to hashes. And so that means we're not supposed to use MD5 anymore. Indeed, you may be suffering, I have suffered from, you may suffer from websites that use MD5 as their part of their signature algorithms. And the browsers, Chrome first and then Firefox, started to say, no, we're not going to let you talk to those sites because it's too dangerous. So when you encounter that, you have to go to the site and say, look, folks, your security is not up to snuff. I'm not going to do internet business with you. And if I can't do internet business with you, I'm not going to do business with you at all. So you better fix it. Okay? So, and notice that the word is deprecated, not depreciated. It's a different concept. Deprecated means it still exists, but you're not supposed to use it. Okay, SHA-1 is a later algorithm. I think SHA-1 may actually now be in the same status as MD5. Not supposed to use it anymore. It happened a little later. There are replacements called SHA-256. SHA-512 that are still acceptable, and the 256 and 512 refer to the size of the hash that is computed.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it says there. SHA-1 deprecated. All right. So we're out of time, but next time we'll pick up and see how to deal with this fact that we don't know that the public key really belongs to Alice. Okay?
So do you push the Friday community and then also